podcast from the Center for Children, Families, and Workforce Development at the University of Montana. I'm your host, Zach Reamer. Now, this episode will be part two of a series we started last time on drug-impacted babies. In the last episode, we talked with Marshall Lambert at the Bureau of Indian Affairs, Rocky Mountain Region, who gave us a direct service worker's perspective on working with these children and families, especially as it pertains to Montana's American Indian communities and reservations. Now, I thought this was a really valuable perspective, so I'd really encourage you to go back and give it a listen. You can find that episode on our website or back in iTunes, probably around the same place that you found this episode. So this time around, we'll be taking a deeper dive into what's actually going on with the child themselves, physiologically, developmentally, physically, and mentally. To do this, we've brought in an expert who knows quite a bit more about the medical side of things than I do, and her name is Bonnie Stevens. She works at the Community Medical Center in Missoula, Montana. So why don't we just jump right into the conversation that I had with Dr. Stevens. So Dr. Stevens, would you mind introducing yourself?
My name's Bonnie Stevens. I'm a neonatologist and a developmental and behavioral pediatrician. I did my training in pediatrics in Chicago, Illinois, at Northwestern University, and then I did a combined fellowship in developmental and behavioral pediatrics and neonatology out at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. And I'm specifically interested in, you know, obviously the acute care that happens in the NICU, but also the developmental follow-up of children that are high risk that have spent time in the NICU, you know, over the course of their lifespan. And so that's kind of what I do. And then here in Missoula, I'm the medical director of the neonatal intensive care unit. I run our NICU follow-up program, and I also have a general developmental and behavioral pediatrics clinic at our pediatric specialties clinic.
I'm really excited to hear you say that you're interested in that period afterwards and the developmental implications. Because I think that's something that we're running across that we don't know how to answer that question, and it's kind of hard to find information on it. But let's maybe start at the beginning. Can you tell us what happens to a newborn as they're exposed to drugs in the womb, physically, neurologically?
Sure. So, you know, there's a lot of things that happen. I think primarily what is focused on in the NICU is the fact that just as anyone who's exposed to a chronic level of an addictive substance, the brain of the fetus and then newborn becomes addicted to that substance, and then they once a newborn is born and they're ex utero, they are cut off from the supply of that substance that they've been chronically and regularly exposed to, and they undergo physiologic withdrawal the same way that an adult would if they were to say go cold turkey from the
right
substance that they had been using. And so there's truly a physiologic withdrawal that happens for those neonates. For some, it's mild, and for some, it's more severe. If it's more severe, then it needs to be treated by replacing that substance and then doing a slow taper off that substance to wean them safely rather than having them go cold turkey, so
right
to speak. You know, I think there's more that happens, or there's clearly more that happens to the fetal and neonatal brain when it's exposed to those kinds of substances, because as opposed to when an adult exposes their brain to that substance, our brains are fully developed,
right,
correct? When a fetus is exposed, that's a developing brain. And so there are clearly other effects on that brain from being exposed to this substance at really a critical time period of brain growth and
yeah,
maturation.
At the beginning, the first couple of weeks, really seeing the withdrawal symptoms. Can you tell me some more about what those are?
Sure. So typically for infants that are exposed specifically to narcotics, so specifically to opiates, they undergo kind of this classic set of withdrawal symptoms. And those include neurologic symptoms, so things like tremors, increased muscle tone, sometimes myoclonus, and sometimes even seizure activity.
Yeah.
They have gastrointestinal symptoms, so vomiting, diarrhea. And then they have autonomic symptoms, so things that are more sort of central to their core brainstem physiology. So things like increased respiratory rate, inability to regulate their own body temperature, sweating, yawning, kind of more nonspecific symptoms. And what we see is that for every infant, the combination of symptoms that they have is slightly different. But what we're looking for is not one specific symptom, but really more these symptoms that become additive and really display a picture of more mild, moderate, or severe withdrawal. Typically, that withdrawal will peak, depending on the substance that they're exposed to, somewhere around 3 to 5 days of life. And then if it peaks and is manageable with non-pharmacologic treatment, then they work through it on their own. If it peaks at a high enough level that pharmacological treatment is required, then they end up needing to be treated for that, mm-hmm. and that prolongs their time in a hospital or an acute setting. And so that's the acute phase.
And so with the pharmacological treatments, we're talking about things like methadone and...
Yeah, so in neonates, there's two ways to treat withdrawal from an opiate. And again, I'm specifically sort of speaking about opiates when I talk about this neonatal abstinence syndrome that we see. And there are lots of other non-opiate medications that infants can be exposed to that cause more subtle changes and probably have similar effects on the developing brain long term, mm-hmm. but not this specific neonatal abstinence syndrome that we see.
Yes.
So there are two ways to treat that. One is with methadone and one is with morphine. Yeah. I would say that there are different institutions that will use one versus the other. The literature supports the use of either. We use morphine in our NICU, and in actually all of the NICUs where I've worked, that has been the treatment of choice. And the reason for that is that it's a shorter-acting medication, so it's easier to titrate so that you're not as apt to accidentally overdose an infant. And it's more straightforward in terms of weaning that substance. It does mean that the infant needs to be in a hospital setting, specifically in a NICU, for the duration of that drug taper.
Because of the length of time for that. Sorry to catch up. The infant typically stays, like you said, it kind of varies.
It does. And it varies a lot. And it's not clear why that is, because it doesn't necessarily correlate with the drug that the mom was using, with the dose of her medication. It does seem that moms that are using multiple different substances will often have infants who take longer to withdraw, but not always. So it varies. And I would say if an infant goes through their symptoms of neonatal abstinence, they peak at a lower level, don't need pharmacologic treatment, then typically within a week, those acute symptoms are much, much better. If they need pharmacologic treatment, that treatment can last anywhere from 10 days to a couple of months. Mm-hmm.
So how about after these children go home? And from our perspective, you know, we are interested in foster families as well, you know, people who are bringing these children in without having experienced that first neonatal abstinence syndrome. Mm-hmm. So what are people seeing kind of 1.5, 2 years down the line?
And that's hard. I will say that there's a lot of anecdotal information about what people are seeing. There's not a lot of, as you've probably discovered in your own research, there's not a lot of good studies out there looking at in an organized scientific way what kind of outcomes we're seeing at a year to 2 years. And there's many reasons for that. Mm-hmm. I think anecdotally, I think there's clear evidence that subacute withdrawal lasts for many months. So infants that undergo acute withdrawal, whether they need pharmacologic treatment or not, mm-hmm. Go through a period for several months where they have more subacute withdrawal. So they may be more irritable. They may have more sort of soft neurologic signs that can persist until they're, you know, close to a year mm-hmm. of age. At a year, 2 years of age, I would say that anecdotally, there are reports of increased rates of behavioral differences,
sure.
challenges. But I think that it's hard to tease out because there hasn't been rigorous scientific studies done on this, mm-hmm. because follow-up rates are poor, because there's a lot of other factors involved. You mentioned foster care. It's hard to study a group of kids who are exposed to different kinds of substances at different doses, with parents who have different physiology, mm-hmm. in infants who have different physiology, some of whom go home with their biological parents, some of whom go home with family foster, some of whom go home in non-familial foster care, and to sort out the effects of all of those individual things on then the physiology that you see in an infant at a year or two or 10 or 20 years.
Right, and there's that problem. We've got this increase in Montana and across, I think, the country
yes.
of foster children, children in the foster system and these group of kids coming in with these experiences and having gone through all of that. So I think the real kind of money question here is what's going to happen as they age into the school system? And
right.
What are our best guesses? Because like we've said already, we don't really have a lot of studies that have told us exactly what we should expect.
Right. And I think there's data out there that there are probably higher rates of things like attention deficit hyperactivity mm-hmm. disorder. There are probably higher rates of other behavioral disorders. There may be higher rates of some specific learning disabilities. Mm-hmm. But I think the data is not strong. And I wish that there was more, but it's hard data to collect, I think, because of you know, all of the challenges that I mentioned before. Mm-hmm. So
maybe I'm asking you now to go a little bit out of your profession, but what do you think are the what if we don't account for this? What happens if we don't understand what's coming down the pipe, so to speak?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of things. I think for the individual child, they may not get the help that they need. Mm-hmm. It may be that they have a difficulty that isn't recognized until later than it would have been otherwise. Rather than knowing they're at risk and screening for them and being screening for those difficulties and being able to provide them with support mm-hmm. right away, those difficulties may not be discovered until they're already failing in school
sure.
or with friendships or in their family dynamic. And so for the individual, those I think would be the potential effects. I think for the system, I mean, you could probably speak to that better than I, but I think if we've got an increase in opiate addiction, we've got an increase in moms who are addicted, who are having babies, who have these kinds of difficulties with withdrawal and potential behavioral and developmental consequences down the line, then we have a system that needs to shift and be able to support a higher population of children that struggle with these difficulties. And if we're not prepared for that, then that's going to have a much bigger systemic effect.
Yeah, and part of that is I'm not so sure that we're getting a full picture. Do you have any idea on the scope and if it's being underreported or if we're just not sure how many children are being born affected by drugs?
Yeah, I think that's hard to speak to. My guess is that it's underreported because there's again a lot of other psychological factors involved. You know, this is something that no one intends to have a drug addicted baby, mm-hmm. And so this is something where moms are struggling with an addiction that they don't want to have.
Absolutely.
They feel guilty about it. They want to provide the best care for their babies, but they feel judged, and so it would not surprise me if there's underreporting involved because it's something that some moms even find hard to admit to themselves, let alone to others, that this is something that they're dealing with.
Yeah, I think that's an important point to consider is that the parents are definitely dealing with a lot of issues as well, and hopefully they're being connected to services as they come in and do get help.
Hopefully, and that's our goal. You know, my colleagues in the obstetrics world really work hard to get these moms connected to services
yeah.
that can help them. Unfortunately, there are fewer resources out there than there are people who need them.
Okay, so let me back up just a little bit.
Sure.
And I'm curious, one thing I've been wondering is there a difference between, say, opioids, a baby who's addicted to opioids versus amphetamines or stimulant versus alcohol or cigarettes?
Sure. So those infants that are addicted to opiates, we touched on, I mentioned the neonatal abstinence syndrome, which is really classically defined as that opiate withdrawal
okay.
or withdrawal from opiates for someone who's been exposed chronically and then no longer is. The effects of exposure to methamphetamine are different. Methamphetamine and cocaine mm-hmm. are stimulants, and they don't have the classic withdrawal picture mm-hmm. that opiates have. When we see infants exposed to those substances, we tend to see more of an acute intoxication, where actually, interestingly, the symptoms overlap a lot with intoxication in an infant, mm-hmm. intoxication with methamphetamine or cocaine, and withdrawal from an opiate. So, but then, similar to exposure with opiates, the effect of exposure to any of these substances on the developing brain creates neurologic differences.
Mm-hmm.
As the brain develops, it develops in part based on genetics and
sure.
your internal biology, but in part because of experience. And neurologic pathways are formed and are broken down based on the experiences we have, whether those experiences are positive or negative, and they're based on the exposures we have. whether intended or not. And so exposure to any substance can alter that neurologic development and that the trajectory of that neurologic development in a way that results in neurologic differences. In the newborn period, it's often this just sort of neurologic irritability. I talked about that sort of subacute withdrawal. It's not that that at that point the baby is physiologically really truly missing those substances, but probably more that there's been a change in the way that their brain structure and function has developed based on their exposure. And so there's a similarity in from that standpoint in that exposure to these neurologically toxic substances are having that kind of subacute and chronic effect.
So maybe you've already answered this question, but I just don't know. Is it important from your point of view as a physician to know what type of drug the baby has been exposed to?
Yes. It's important primarily in the NICU because it affects how we treat those infants, not from a non-pharmacologic standpoint. From a non-pharmacologic standpoint, they're all treated similarly. I mean, we want low stimulation environments that are calming and soothing. We want moms to be present, feeding their infants, holding their infants. From a pharmacologic standpoint, there's a big difference in that withdrawal from methamphetamine and cocaine is not something that we treat the same way because, again, it's not really an acute withdrawal from that substance.
Okay, you took my maybe poorly conceived question and answered it exactly.
Oh, good.
So thank you.
You know, you mentioned alcohol and tobacco as well. We do see infants that are exposed to chronic levels of nicotine have similar, although lower level in terms of severity, withdrawal symptoms. So the same kind of neuroirritability that you will see. We don't typically see the gastrointestinal and autonomic symptoms that we see with opiate withdrawal, but we see some of the same kind of neurologic irritability that we would see. And alcohol is a whole different ballgame. There's a well-described fetal alcohol syndrome and fetal alcohol effects that really have very significant effects on a child and their long-term development, cognitive development, but have less of an acute effect in the NICU setting.
Okay, so maybe we can shift to how can we help? What do, let's say, parents need to know to better care for these children?
I think parents that are faced with taking home a baby who has or is going through withdrawal from a substance need to know some of what we just spoke about acute withdrawal, subacute withdrawal, that our intention is to help get these babies through their acute withdrawal in a safe way, but that even when that has happened, when they go home, that the subacute withdrawal persists and that there is the chance that they will have a baby who doesn't sleep as well, who doesn't eat as well, and who is much more irritable than another child who wasn't exposed to these substances. And I think that's important because it impacts parent-child relationships and it impacts safety for that child. These are not always, but can be, painfully frustrating children to care for. And if parents don't have support to help them through that, and if parents haven't been taught that sometimes when you've done everything you can to soothe your baby, it's okay to set them down in a safe place in their safe sleep environment and walk away and take a deep breath, that sometimes unintentional harm can come to these children just out of pure frustration. And so I think it's really important that we sit down and have these conversations with families about the fact that, you know, put it all out there on the table. This happens. And we talk to all of our moms for infants who are substance exposed or not about shaken baby and about the fact that no one intends to shake their child, but that sometimes babies get very, very upset and are difficult to soothe. And it's very important that we know ahead of time that shaken baby is something that happens so that we can do everything in our power to try to prevent ourselves from being the one that acts in a way that could cause that. So I think that's crucial.
And I'm sure it's a hard conversation to have.
It is. But we make it part of our routine for every baby in the NICU before they go home.
That's great. So, and then are there referrals that you are able to make outside of that kind of going forward in their own lives?
Yeah, so we have a public health nurse that can come and visit with families, and we make those referrals when families are willing to have those nurses come in and just support them in the home setting. My developmental NICU follow-up clinic will see children and monitor their development on an ongoing basis. We, for families that are interested in early intervention services, those are available where someone monitors their development on a more frequent basis through the Part C or early intervention services. And then, of course, their general pediatricians monitor not just their medical problems, but their growth and their development and ongoing potential relationship or psychological issues that go along with this.
So let me ask one more question kind of on this front. How can the number of drug-impacted births be reduced? We've kind of been talking about, you know, what to do afterwards, but is there something that physicians, parents, families can be doing on the front end?
Sure, and I think that's a huge question.
Big question. Yeah, let's answer it right now.
Right. I think people are working on that from a variety of angles right now. We spoke earlier about legislation, and I think there's been some legislation coming that has been recently implemented, but also coming down the pike about really kind of monitoring prescribing practices and really making sure that's a focus and that physicians are accountable for their prescribing practices. Mm-hmm. Turning that around, there are a lot of states now have prescription drug registries.
And Montana is one of them.
Where patients are held accountable for their own use, their own usage. I think those are two ways to come at the problem from different angles, but important angles in terms of just making sure that we're being responsible in terms of trying to prevent addiction in the first place. Once a mom is pregnant and addicted to a substance, what she's probably looking at is having a child that goes through some level of withdrawal. Because it's not safe to go through the same kind of detoxification that someone might do when they weren't pregnant to get off of that substance that they're addicted to. And so really prevention of addiction I see as being the way, so that the way to prevent these kinds of exposures to infants, so that women aren't going into a pregnancy already addicted. Answer that question.
I think
I don't know if that...
No, you know, it's, you said it right at the beginning, is that it's a big question to answer, and I think maybe something that I've experienced in my research is that everybody has answers to kind of help.
Right.
You just have to try to bring
those
into
together
a little bit. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Find a continuum of care. I think we like to use that
absolutely
word.
And I think prevention is huge, you know, for many
absolutely
things, and this being a big one.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. So what kind of changes do you think should occur to try to better serve these families and these children?
That's a big question, too.
Yeah, so from your perspective as a physician.
Right. I think some of what has happened needs, in our desire to help these moms get the care that they need, feel supported in their decisions, feel supported in their ability to care for their child, bond with their child, despite the fact that they're struggling with an addiction and their child potentially is struggling with addiction and behavioral issues after birth, needs to continue and increase. You know, ultimately, as I mentioned before, no mom intends to have a baby that's addicted to drugs, and all moms want to provide the best possible care for their baby. I think there are times where these moms feel judged and feel unable to provide the care that they're biologically programmed
right
to provide.
And they want to.
And that
yeah
they want to provide. And I think these families will all be better off in the long run if we're able to support them as families and support them through what they're all going through as a family.
I think we've tackled all the big questions. I think we may have answered a few of them.
Okay.
And those are some good words to wrap it up. But any last words of advice for anybody working with these families or children, you know, from teachers to social workers to that, you know, any profession really, these kids are going to probably come into contact with a lot of helping professions down the line.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think one is just be aware that this is out there, be aware that we're seeing increased rates, have it on your radar, and
And I think we all need to be aware of how few resources are actually out there, and really think about what it is that we all each need to do to help increase those resources, whether it be something that we do as an individual or something that we, you know, support in terms of legislation. Mm-hmm. And in order to increase services for folks that are struggling with these kinds of issues.
Great advice. Well, I really appreciate it. I was excited to come in and talk with you, and I'm even more excited now that I've learned all of this information. So thanks again.
Absolutely. Happy to do it.
So that's the end of my interview with Dr. Stevens, and I really got a lot of information. I hope you did too. But at this point, some of you might be thinking, wait a second. We didn't really talk about how to stop this in depth. What can we do? What can I do? Well, Dr. Stevens was feeling kind of the same way, so she actually called me back and asked to say just a little bit more on that subject.
So I think to reduce the number of addicted, of births affected by addiction, you know, obviously prevention of addiction is one way. I think in addition, education so that women are aware that those who are suffering from addiction, really, if they're thinking about having kids, really need to be getting treatment for their addiction ahead of time. Because again, once they're pregnant, it's too late. It's not safe to go through a detox program. Many women find it much more difficult to wean from the substances they're taking during pregnancy, and it's often not safe to do. So just the knowledge that if they are planning to have that planning include getting help for their addiction before they get pregnant. And then thirdly, we all know that not all pregnancies are intended. And there are women who suffer from addiction who become pregnant who don't intend to do so. And I think that in order for us to address that and help prevent that from happening, women need access to affordable birth control so that they can have some control over their own family planning and helping to prevent this from happening to them.
Yeah, I really like the way that you frame that as giving them control over their family planning. And perhaps not putting the burden solely on women, but if men are in a clinic and they ask for, or maybe a clinician should ask if they would like some, if it's...
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And, you know, it's it takes two.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, definitely.
And so one other thing that I was, as you were saying these things, that I started thinking about was something that we have actually talked about before. And that was just kind of the feeling that women have when they realize that they are pregnant while also actively addicted to a substance, and the shame and doubt that can come with that.
And fear, I think. Yes.
Absolutely. So, yeah, I don't know if you have anything else to say about that, but I feel like that's a really important aspect of bringing these women in and working with them and making them feel, first of all, comfortable to even admit this situation and then go forward with treatment and...
Yeah, and you know, a lot of women that suffer from addiction don't seek health care and may not seek prenatal care even once they become pregnant. And so as much as we can destigmatize addiction, recognize that this is a medical problem that people need and deserve help for, and once again, making the message be that we know that no one intends to have a drug addicted baby, and that we want simply to help support and empower women to do what they can to prevent that from happening, or to handle it when it does in a way that's safest for themselves and for their baby.
Okay, so that's actually the last of my time with Dr. Stevens, and I just got to say, her job has to be a really difficult one. But I am, for one, very thankful to know that someone like that is taking care of our most vulnerable population. You know who else I'm thankful for? You, the listeners. You're listening to this because you want to help, and I know you'll go out there and do that. So keep it up. All right, if you're wanting more, then the best way to learn a ton is to go to our website. You can find the Center for Children, Families, and Workforce Development website at health.umt.edu/CCFWD. Again, that's health.umt.edu/CCFWD. We've got a ton of resources on there, and this is where we'll also be posting new episodes of the podcast. And that's it. If you liked what you heard and you want to tell us about it, or if you have suggestions for future episodes of the podcast or somebody to interview, just send us an email or find us on Facebook. Our email address is ccfwd@mso.umt.edu. And again, you can find us on Facebook as well. All of this information is on our website. We really look forward to hearing from you. All right then, take care of yourself this week, and we'll see you next time.